hear argument now in the case of United States against Sadler.
Please, the court. Good morning. My name is Imani Shafei, and I represent the appellant, Karan Sadler. Mr. Sadler was seized in violation of the Fourth Amendment because Chicago police officers in this case stopped him without having reasonable suspicion to do so. In this case, the officer stopped Mr. Sadler based on a secondhand tip that a heavyset African-American man with a bald head was walking in near a certain location and was in possession of a gun. The tip or information passed on to the officers gave no predictive information, and there was no information where the officer could corroborate with the tip or the information given by the tip. Furthermore, the caller failed to give any information regarding the clothing that the person was wearing, the color of the clothing, the person's height, the person's age, or the complexion of the person's skin. At the time of the stop, there was no evidence, apart from the tip, that Mr. Sadler was committing or had committed a crime in this case. Therefore, Your Honors, the police did not have specific or articulable reasonable suspicion to stop Mr. Sadler. In determining whether officers have furnished enough verifiable information to provide reasonable suspicion to make a stop, we must examine, one, the degree of the reliability, two, the amount of police corroboration, and the information given. In essence, we must look at the totality of the circumstances. A tip that provides no predictive information, therefore leaves the police without the means to judge the informant's knowledge or credibility.
Well, there's definitely a person with a gun, and they, I believe, at least to be imputed, wasn't that initially reported that this person was a gang member?
That was the information that was given to the 911 operator. That information was not passed along.
But isn't that enough? Isn't it kind of a cumulative thing? You can't say everything over the when you dispatch.
Well, Your Honor, the information given by the caller to the 911 operator was that the caller believed the person was in a gang or in the neighborhood gang. The information given to the officers was just a heavy-set African-American man believed to be in possession of a gun near a certain location.
Bald.
That information was so general that even the officers during the suppression hearing testified that they would have stopped any person walking in that general area who was heavy-set African-American with a bald head. I understand the honest question about whether we should impute the knowledge or all the information that the 911 officers had. I think even if we impute that knowledge, we would argue that it still wasn't a reasonable suspicion to make the stop in this case. But there's a Second Circuit case, an exact situation, a 911 officer, where the court held in the Second Circuit that the information should not be imputed where there is no reason to believe that the 911 operator could make any distinction about whether that information was enough for reasonable suspicion or not. And we think in this case that information shouldn't be imputed. But even if you impute that information, the only thing that adds is the caller believes the person was in the gang, bald head, heavy set, African-American, walking in this area. That information, Your Honor, is not enough, we believe, to give reasonable suspicion to make a stop. Still, no predictive information provided. There was no way for the police officers to judge whether this was the person that the caller was referring to in this matter.
Well, I noticed he didn't say anything about what he was wearing. That probably would have helped.
What he was wearing, his height. The information was so general that, as I stated earlier, the officers testified at the suppression hearing, they would have stopped every African-American person who fit that description. Or I shouldn't even say African-American. Every person who fit that description. Black, bald head, heavy set. That information, even if you want to impute the knowledge of a person was believed to be in a gang, wouldn't have helped the officers at all, because there was nothing about a person's outwardly appearance, at least in this case, on the record in this case, that would have led the officers to believe whether or not the person was in a gang or not. And so what the officers testified is that they were making a stop based on the physical description. And that information, even if you impute the gang information, that would not have assisted the officers in making a stop in this case. As I've stated, Your Honors, is that in this case, there was no predictive information, no information for the police to corroborate the basis for their stop. There was no information that the police used to test the informant's reliability. And in addition, I think what makes this case different from a lot of the cases cited is that this was really a secondhand tip. And so the person who made the call didn't witness any of the information they were passing along to the 911 operator. That information came from an employee of theirs. And so what we have here in this case is a secondhand tip with information so generic or so general, where the police officers themselves admitted that they would have stopped every African-American person who fit the description. We think, Your Honor, that that information did not give the police officers in this case reasonable suspicion to make a stop here. There was no predictive information, and it wasn't corroborated.
Was there any indication they stopped anybody else?
There is no, they did not, according to the officer's testimony, and in the record, they didn't stop anyone else. It was approximately, the officers stopped Mr. Sadler approximately 10 to 15 minutes after the initial call, around 15 to 20 minutes after the initial call came in. It's approximately 12 in the afternoon. They didn't stop anyone else. Mr. Sadler was the first person they saw that fit that description, but they testified and admitted on the witness standard on the suppression hearing that they would have stopped anybody who fit that description. I'll save the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Mm-hmm.
Certainly, counsel. Mr. Heisted.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, again for the United States, my name is Cliff Heisted. Under the totality of the circumstances in this case, that 911 call exhibited sufficient indicia of reliability to provide reasonable suspicion for these police officers to do what they did in this case. This is not the case of a secondhand tip. This is not a case of an anonymous informant whose word needs to be corroborated. This is the case of a 911 emergency call that of a type that this court in United States versus Drake has held to be sufficient for police officers to do precisely what they did in this case. In Drake, this court held, we therefore presume the reliability of an eyewitness 911 call reporting an emergency situation for purposes of establishing reasonable suspicion, particularly where, as in this case, the caller identifies him or herself. So what happened in this case is Mr. Sadler presented himself at a certain location. A person who was there saw him with a pistol in his waistband. This person immediately called the owner of the shop and informed him that he had seen Mr. Sadler, a person he knew lived in the neighborhood, a person who he knew or believed to be a gang member, and a person whose nickname he knew. His nickname was Black. The employee who saw the defendant called his employer and said, Black is here, I can see a pistol in his waistband. And according to the record, the employer then called 911 and said, there is a person outside my shop, this is the name of my store, this is the address of my store. The caller identified himself by name, even offered to give his telephone number. Again, this is not an anonymous tip, this is not uncorroborated or unverifiable information, and told the 911 operator about the person with a gun at a precise location just minutes before the call. The 911 operator then asked for additional information, at which time the employer, the owner of the store, on a second phone, called the employee, the person who had minutes before actually seen Mr. Sadler with the pistol, and asked the questions that the 911 operator wanted to know. With one hand, the 911 caller said, "Where did he go? Where did Black go?" calling him by the nickname by which they both mutually knew him. And then the employee said, "He's still there?" I mean, the 911 recording shows that the defendant was still actually present while the caller was talking to the 911 operator on one call and talking on another call with a person who was in actual line of sight communication with the defendant who had a pistol in his waistband. The person who saw the defendant said, "He's in the area of Armitage in St. Louis. I think he's headed south on St. Louis." This information was instantaneously, contemporaneously provided to the 911 operator. The caller said, "I'm afraid of this man. I'm afraid of the people he hangs around with. I believe he's in a gang. I know he lives around here. I want to remain anonymous." And other than the request to remain anonymous, which was somewhat incompatible with the fact that he had made complete and full disclosure of his identity, that's the only reference in this case to there being an anonymous tip, his request to remain anonymous. But the fact is, and as the district court held, he was in fact not anonymous. In fact, it appears that he had future communications with law enforcement after these incidents, which led to the government requesting that the 911 tape be sealed. That request was made, I believe the record will show, by the person whose identity wanted to be kept secret. So in any event,
the dispatch referred to this as an anonymous tip.
Correct.
Right? And does that make any legal difference?
I suspect it does not, because the information came from a person who was willing to expose himself.
And that was a mistake, obviously, by the dispatcher, because it wasn't an anonymous tip. But so far as the officers in the field knew, it was an anonymous tip?
As far as the officers in the field knew, it was an anonymous tip. Your Honor, I'm not sure that this is in the record, but I can elaborate on the anonymity situation with respect to 911 callers, if you'd like.
You mean as far as how the system works in general?
Yes.
Which is publicly available knowledge?
It is, Your Honor. A person can request anonymity, and in fact, the Office of Emergency Management and Communication, the 911 call center, is directed in writing to respect that wish. So it's standard operating procedure in a case like this, that somebody can remain anonymous, and the 911 operator is obligated to respect that. So this information then was transferred out to the police department. The police officers in this case said that they received information from the 911 call center, not from some person answering the phone at the police department, but from the 911 call center, the Office of Emergency Management and Communication, that a person with a gun was seen at a specific address just minutes before, and that they were heading in a certain direction. The police officers, who were only blocks away, turned around, drove around the area, and they saw a person fitting the description one block away from where they were told the person had been just minutes before, the heavyset, black, bald man. They drove up to him. They approached him. They asked him to come over to their car. They asked him to put his hands down on the hood of the car. They asked him whether he had a gun. He said that he did. They did a pat-down search. They found the gun. Therefore, probable cause to arrest arose. They arrested him, and that's how this case came before Your Honor. This is not an anonymous tip that required corroboration. This is not an anonymous tip without sufficient reliability that would give us pause to doubt the reasonable suspicion. This is a call that came out that is exactly of the type that this court and several other circuits have held. We will show special deference to 911 emergency calls because of the nature of these calls, because of the social policy served by police officers being able to readily speed to the scene of an emergency. We're not going to make them stop and drive to the 911 caller and try to do a secondary investigation before responding to a call of an ongoing crime. This was an ongoing crime. As we know, it's against the law to possess a firearm in the city of Chicago. They were investigating an ongoing crime.
The dispatch also included information that the suspect was known to live in the neighborhood. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And at least one of the officers, responding officers, knew or recognized the defendant by his and knew his nickname?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Is there anything in the record about whether he also knew that he lived in the neighborhood?
There's nothing in the record that the officer who knew the defendant knew that he lived in the area, but we do know that both the 911 caller and the police officer who arrested the defendant both knew that same person by the nickname Black.
But the nickname wasn't dispatched, only that it was someone who lived in the neighborhood.
That's correct, Your Honor. But as the court in Drake pointed out, that knowledge of the 911 operator is appropriately imputed to the police officers under the collective knowledge doctrine. So if there are no further questions, then the government will rest on its brief. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Chabet?
And I just want to stress again that the officers, even though one officer didn't know the name Black, that information was not passed along from the operator. The information that officers were working with was heavyset African-American man with a bald head in a certain location, walking in a certain area. In addition, with regards to Drake, the facts were significantly different. In Drake, the caller who made the 911 call was witnessing the actual events, gave a detailed description of the persons that she was calling about, description of the cars the persons could be found in a specific location. And the officers went to that location and found the persons, the suspects in Drake, at that location in the automobiles described by the caller. And so that case, we believe, is significantly different in this case than the case before the court because of the information provided. And in addition, just because, even if we put to one side whether or not the caller was anonymous or not, it's still, the officer still must have reasonable suspicion. Just because you have an informant tip doesn't relieve the government, other officers, of determining whether the reliability of the tip, there still must be corroboration and predictive information. And so just because the fact that the tip wasn't anonymous doesn't remove the things that these things or these steps that the officers have to go through to determine whether there's a reasonable suspicion to make a stop. Granted, there's more reliability from just a regular tip than anonymous tips, but these things, these steps still must, these things must still be there before reasonable suspicion can be determined. There's nothing further. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.